8:30, and we have with us live in the studios Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good. Thought I'd turn the tables on you this morning. You always ask
away.
How I am.
Yeah. Thanks. No, thank you. So, no job this week. He's what? Out?
He's out camping.
Playing Daniel Boone or something. Boy Scout. I guess Daniel Boone wouldn't necessarily be a good
job's
role
not a
model.
Big man either.
Not a role model for job.
Anyway.
So, I wanted to start out and give you kudos for, I saw an article in the this morning's PI saying the city of Seattle now projects a revenue shortfall, and you had, of course, predicted that months ago,
yeah.
I don't know how many months ago it was, but it was quite a while
yeah,
back.
Yeah, looking at the budget and what they had projected as incoming revenue, and what I know about how the economy was going, it was pretty obvious that they were making projections that were way too optimistic. And I had warned that they might run up against that problem later in the year, and it's come a lot sooner than I expected.
So perhaps maybe they ought to look at hiring some different financial analysts.
Or at least not listening to so much of the economic happy talk that's been going on lately.
So, and I know Greg Nichols is looking at doing some cutbacks in the city. Maybe he could start with his $136,000 a year, taking a little cut there.
Yeah.
did you know Tim Sice, his deputy mayor, actually makes only $5,000 less than him.
So really?
He's doing pretty good, too. $131,000.
It kind of begs the question as to who's actually doing the real work there. Is it Tim Sice or is it Greg Nichols?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move along. I think there was a lot of people who, over on the East Coast, the Northeast Coast of the United States, that were pretty darn surprised a couple days ago.
Yeah, that's right. Within the space of about 10 seconds and over the course of about 5 minutes, some 50 million people were plunged into darkness, I believe, on Thursday. And the blackouts happened mostly in New York State, New England, the upper Midwest, most notably in Detroit and Cleveland. And in southern parts of Canada, including Toronto and Ottawa, two of Canada's largest cities. In Cleveland, it was particularly bad because people got a real taste of what it's like to live in Basra or Baghdad these days, because there was no electricity to pump water. People were completely out of water. There was no electricity to pump sewage or treat sewage, so the sewage treatment plants backed up. It was really quite terrible. So without lights, without air conditioning, without water, without sewage treatment, and extremely hot weather, people here in the U.S. finally got a little taste of what's been going on over in Iraq. And it's become pretty easy to see now why people are rioting in Iraq these days. Now, the cause, I opened the newspaper this morning, the PI, and I was interested to scan about three or four different articles, each of them talking about the cause and kind of scratching their heads and saying, well, it's the transmission lines, the transmission power grid is pretty old, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yeah, that's true. But there's a deeper cause. The transmission grid is only the physical aspect of a deeper cause, and the deeper cause is the privatization and the deregulation of the power system. Now, the power plants have been privatized. The transmission lines, some of them have been privatized, and in some cases it's not exactly clear who owns and who is responsible for caring for the actual power lines in large parts of the country, and that's never really been adequately straightened out. Now, in places where private companies own the power lines, own the grid, there's really been no incentive to replace the lines and switches. Some of them date back to the 1950s. It's because power companies can't really make any fees by charging other power companies to transport power over their lines. So there really isn't any incentive or any way for companies to make back the money that they would invest in replacing the power grid, the old switches and the old lines that are up right now. Now, back in the 1970s, if we look back a ways, you'll maybe remember if you were alive then, that regional and local power plants were owned by the public, pretty much served the general area where they were located. And it was the general public that paid for upgrades to the system through increases in power rates on their electric bills. The public power company would have to come to the city or the state and say, we need more money, and then there would be a bill drafted, and it would pass or it wouldn't pass, depending on how much money was in the budget, et cetera, et cetera. That's not how it works anymore. Privatization now means that municipalities, like the city of Seattle, for example, can shop around now for power from different places, even different regions of the country, in order to get the best deal and the lowest price. Now, what that means is that these private companies who own these power plants now, they really can't do upgrades to their system the same way that public companies could do, because the companies that don't do upgrades, that save the most money that way, can actually charge the lowest rates to the municipalities. And so they get the most customers, and so they have an advantage over companies that put money into upgrading their systems. Now, these companies that have the most customers that don't make upgrades, they have the lowest margins, and there's really nothing left over for them after they've paid shareholders, which is really their first priority, is to pay their shareholders, to put back into upgrading the system anyway. So it's kind of like a little vicious cycle. Now, on top of this, there's also the Enron effect, something that hasn't been discussed much at all in the U.S. press here, although I was interested to see that the BBC had an article on this where they discussed the Enron effect, and I'm like, I was looking at that thinking, huh?
Yeah, it seemed obvious to them.
It was obvious to them. It's not obvious to us. That's pretty strange. But the Enron effect I want to describe a little bit. When Enron collapsed, it drove down the stock prices of energy companies within the entire industry, because the energy companies in the industry, many of them had engaged in similar practices to Enron, maybe not futzing with their balance sheet the way Enron had, but they were engaged in a lot of the same businesses and had a lot of debt too. So stockholders looked at their stock and said, well, we're not paying these high prices for this stock. We don't have confidence in these companies. And at the same time, people who buy and sell corporate debt, corporate bonds, etc., they downgraded, pretty much sold off those bonds and said, well, we don't have confidence these companies can pay back their debt. Their debt was downgraded. Those companies now have to pay higher interest on their debt. So they have less money altogether. They have less cash now than they did in the past. So they really can't put much money into the system, even if they wanted to, even if they, say, wanted to suspend payments to their shareholders, or they wanted to charge a little extra for their power. It would be extremely hard for them to put any money into the power, into the grid, into upgrading switches and power lines, etc. So that's the Enron effect, and that has had a pretty profound impact on this. Now, yeah, this can happen anywhere in the U.S. It doesn't necessarily have to be just the Midwest and the East Coast where this can happen. This can happen anywhere. It happened in California when the blackouts occurred there. That was caused by another. It wasn't caused by a system overload like this one was. It was caused by problems in the trading and the flow of power over the system, but it was exacerbated by the poor state of the grid in California. So this is a problem everywhere. It's not just a problem in the places where it's happened now. And what was kind of interesting to me is that there's been none of this discussion of the impact of privatization on this whole disaster here in the U.S. You could only find it really by reading maybe the wire service reports from Reuters and Associated Press and reading the BBC. What you found instead, what you got instead, is you got the former Clinton Energy Secretary, excuse me, Bill Richardson, telling CNN, we're a superpower with a third world grid. Well, I found that really interesting because it's not really true. We're not a superpower with a third world grid. We're a superpower with a third world utility system because we've allowed our public utilities to be sold off the same way they've been sold off and privatized throughout the third world. And now we're getting exactly the same effects that have happened in the third world. A lack of any investment in the public infrastructure means rolling blackouts or these problems are going to occur. Now, in the third world, they're better prepared because in a lot of places, people have excuse me, home or private generators that they fire up when the lights go out, and we don't have that here. What I also thought interesting about Richardson's quote is that he was a member of the Clinton administration, and it was really on Clinton's watch when much of this privatization occurred, so he ought to know. However, he's not telling the truth when he says we just have a third world grid. We really have a whole third world utility system.
And I heard a stat this week that, in fact, a third of the planet, 2 billion people, have no electricity at all. And then you add in another billion that have sporadic electricity. Mm-hmm. So it's really only half the planet that has regular electricity coming
that,
to them.
And that number is actually declining. It's going to be less than half, as we're finding out here, who have access to 24 hours a day electricity.
So it's sounding like then these the deregulation and these big corporations that are running this game are really bringing the third world to all of us finally.
Yes, they are.
So I want to give them a big smooch for that.
That's our corporate scandal of the week.
All right. sticking with corporations, you have an interesting story about SCO.
SCO Group, yes.
Who are they?
SCO Group is a small software company. They took out a suit against IBM in the past, I believe, the past couple of weeks over IBM's selling of the software product Linux. It's a copyright infringement lawsuit. SCO claims that some of its proprietary software code has become embedded in the latest version of Linux. Now, for people who don't know what Linux is, it's an open source software package that is a rival of Microsoft's Windows package. It's an operating system software. Now, what exactly is open source software? Open source software is software that has what you might call an anti-copyright attached to it. It's a specific thing called a general public license. It's not a copyright. It's kind of an anti-copyright. In fact, its inventor, Richard Stallman, called it a copyleft. What it does is it allows people who use Linux, and that can be anyone who wants to use Linux, unlimited copying and modifying rights on the product. So anybody who downloads Linux and wants to use it on their computer can make whatever changes to the code that they want. They can modify it any way that they like. They can write new little software packages that run with it, and then they can make those available to anyone that they want. So it's really a very interesting anti-copyright deal, the general public license.
Whereas the current version, let's say, of the Microsoft products, the Microsoft operating system, you're supposed to supposedly buy copy for each computer you have in your house.
Yeah, you buy one copy of the product, you can install it on two computers, your business computer and your home computer, and that's all. And if you give it to someone else or you try to sell it to somewhere else, you're violating the Microsoft copyright. On the other hand, Linux does not have a copyright. It has the GPL, which is supposed to not just mean that the software is open source, it is supposed to also prevent major corporations or larger companies from trying to copyright Linux, from making minor changes to it and then slapping their own copyright on it and saying this is our proprietary product. The GPL is supposed to prevent that. Now, large companies like IBM, can sell Linux to their customers, but they can't say that it is their proprietary software. They can't prevent people from installing it on as many computers as they like, making as many changes as they like, whatever. Now, there are some significant advantages to having a GPL product, to having an open source product. It's easy for bugs in the software to be ironed out because anybody who is a techie and has experience writing software or debugging it can look at the code. That can't happen with Microsoft Windows. The code is secret, so anyone who buys it cannot just immediately look at the code and make changes to clear up bugs, and then they can't go on and say, look, I've made this great change. Isn't this cool? Isn't this efficient? It makes the software run better. Here it is. You guys can all have it now. And if you want to make changes, too, to make it even better, go right ahead. That can happen with Microsoft Windows. It can happen with Linux, and it has happened. And Linux is a very efficient and very elegant product because of that. Now, furthermore, every techie who contributes to writing Linux, to making changes to Linux, now has a personal interest in seeing that that software continues to be efficient and elegant and continues to have probably much better security than any Microsoft product does now. Now, that's an issue. The security issue is has kind of come to the fore in the past week with this blaster worm that's made its way across the internet and locked up a lot of computers and shut down, you know, major companies and been a problem for Microsoft Windows users. That hasn't happened with Linux, and it likely won't happen with Linux because people are invested in making Linux as secure as possible and writing out the kind of bugs that would make it that vulnerable, the way Windows is vulnerable. Hackers have not had the incentive because Microsoft, in the way that it deals with people and the amount of money it charges for its products, really makes people who need to use it a lot angry in the way that you cannot fix problems, in the way that you cannot copy it to, if you have five computers at home, you have to buy a new product to copy it to two more computers if you want to be illegal. So Microsoft really has set itself up to be a target for hackers, whereas Linux is not in that position. So, and Linux has really been run through all its security paces. When there's a problem, it's fixed quickly because people jump in there and say, gosh, I want to be the person who fixes this problem, and they rewrite the code. Now, IBM, this case is really interesting because IBM has decided to rely on the general public license as its main defense against SCO Group. And what that means is that the general public license will now be tested in a court of law. It hasn't yet been tested in a court of law. And what's encouraging about it all is that because so many businesses and so many government agencies, not just here in the U.S., but also abroad, now use Linux and use other software packages that are open source and that rely on the general public license, that it's going to be really hard for a court of law to try to overturn the GPL. It's pretty likely that the GPL, the general public license concept, will survive and become part of our legal precedent, and I find that extremely encouraging and a really interesting aspect to this case, and I'd like to see really how the case comes out and want to keep my eye on it. It's going through U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City, so if people want to follow that, that's how you can find more information on it.
Hmm. Now, I've heard U.S. District Court in that out of Salt Lake is actually a pretty conservative court down there.
It is, but that is also, I think, something that will help IBM in this case, because here you've got SCO Group is really a small firm. IBM is a large firm, and Linux is being used not just by IBM, but by companies like Dell Computer, sells it on their computers. Let's see, here I've got a little list. Dell Computer uses it. Hewlett Packard also sells computers and pushes Linux on their computers. Other open source software packages like MySQL, a database program, is used by Texas Instruments, Yahoo, Sony, and other major corporations. So there's a lot of open source software packages out there, and a lot of companies are using them because they're recognizing that they're more efficient and they're a better product.
Well, I think for Dell, I don't think it's necessarily like the primary one they push. They like you get an option of like what
you get
want
an option
what you want
yeah.
on your computer when you order it. So,
but they have a number of customers.
They didn't even have that before. It was just strictly Windows was
right.
your option. So
right.
it's significant they're now offering that. So
yeah, and that was part of the whole suit that was against Microsoft for its monopolistic practices, is that Microsoft was forcing these computer manufacturers to not install anything else on their computers and to not offer anything else as an alternative except for Windows. Now that they have the opportunity, they are offering Linux, and a lot of customers are taking them up on it.
All right, well, let's move along. This week in Iraq, more developments, as usual.
Yeah. Yeah, now I talked about the blackouts in the East Coast here. There were riots in Basra last weekend on both Saturday and Sunday, and the cause for those riots is similar to what happened here in the East Coast. It was lack of fuel and continuous blackouts. And whereas we've had something like heat in the 80s and the 90s, here in the U.S. In Iraq, the temperatures have been 120 degrees plus. They've had no refrigeration, no air conditioning, no electricity to pump water. Lots of home generators and air conditioners and stoves that people use for cooking actually run on diesel and kerosene, and there's been a shortage of diesel and kerosene as well in Basra and Baghdad and other places in Iraq, but particularly bad in Basra. Now, there's three reasons for this. First, the U.S. authority hasn't gotten enough of Iraq's oil-generating refinery capacity online or switched over to produce diesel and kerosene, so there's been a real fuel shortage because of that. Now, the main problem is that there are three refineries in the country. There's a refinery at Basra, there's a refinery at Baghdad, and the third refinery is at Baiji, which is north of Baghdad. Now, each of these refineries has had problems. The only one that's really operating with any consistency is the one in Baghdad. The refinery at Baiji has been bombed or sabotaged repeatedly by guerrillas. The one at Basra has been suffering from something that we haven't heard much about, and that's looters, the continuous looting of transmission and power lines in the south of Iraq. So what people are doing is, as soon as transmission lines are being replaced by Kellogg Brown and Root, which is the company that's working to get the refineries up and running.
It's a subsidiary of Halliburton.
Of Halliburton.
Which Dick Cheney gets $1 million from per year.
Yeah, and as soon as those transmission lines are replaced, looters come along, snip them from the pylons and roll them up, rip the copper out, and then sell the copper across the border in Iran. So that's a problem that's been going on continuously, and it means that there's very little fuel for domestic consumption. Now, it's also, there are other things that are responsible for the problem as well. One is also poor planning. The U.S. administration has not planned on how much oil needs to be exported versus how much oil needs to be refined for domestic use. And right now there's some question as to whether the push has been to get oil exported so that money can come flowing into the interim authorities' coffers versus actually serving the domestic population. Now, the power problems are also slowing down the flow of exported oil from Iraq. The southern oil fields down near Basra have been exporting about 500,000 barrels a day. That's, I think, about a sixth of what the U.S. goal is for the country to be exporting. But that's now down to about 200,000 to 300,000 barrels a day, and the problem is being caused by power failures and because of the power lines being cut and rolled up and sold off. Now, oil from the north, there was this big celebratory announcement that, gosh, you know, the U.S. interim authority has gotten oil flowing from Kirkuk to Turkey, finally. It's finally flowing. Well, that was for 2 days. About 2 days after the oil started flowing through the pipeline, dang, big explosion, the pipeline was sabotaged again. So that's going to be a consistent problem for the export oil system. Once again, the northern oil fields are completely cut off. And I want to stress that the longer the oil fields stay idle, the longer these oil wells sit there without the oil being pumped, the more they deteriorate and the less they're able to produce because of pressure in the ground and how the oil is actually pumped to the surface. Eventually, if they stay idle long enough, some of those oil fields will not be productive. Some of those oil wells will not be productive at all, and the U.S. or whoever is in charge when that happens is going to have to go in and drill new wells entirely, and that is very expensive.
We'll probably just transfer it over to the U.N. at that point.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
All right. Did you have other items for what happened in Iraq? We have about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, it's been a pretty bad week over there for random shootings of Iraqi civilians at checkpoints. That's been a problem all along. U.S. troops are pretty nervous because of guerrilla attacks, and they've been opening fire on innocent people in cars who drive a little too fast up to checkpoints or who don't see the checkpoints in time. some of these checkpoints are thrown up very, very quickly late at night after power blackouts have occurred and before the actual curfew goes into effect. People end up trying to rush home so they don't get caught up. And what they find is they turn the corner in their car and there's a checkpoint right there. They don't have time to stop. And so they're getting massacred by U.S. troops with itchy trigger fingers. That's been happening a lot. This week was particularly bad. In one instance in Baghdad, a whole family was mowed down. Four members of the family were killed. It was particularly gruesome because the bystanders tried to reach the father and three of his daughters to take them to the hospital, where if they had been allowed to do that, at least three of the four family members would have survived. But U.S. troops were in such a panic, they wouldn't let any bystanders near. And so those four people died. Others have been shot in this way. And it's been particularly bad this week. Also, a similar mistake was made when U.S. troops killed two Iraqi policemen who were chasing a suspect. This incident was really bad because one of the Iraqi policemen was shot while in his car after his partner got out with his badge in his hand and his hands in the air and shouting, "Police, police," he was shot. And then a third Iraqi policeman in the car crawled out of the car on his hands and knees and put his hands in the air. He was not shot. He was beaten across his chest and back and kicked in the face. This is how nervous and how this is, I think, how combat fatigued U.S. troops are in Iraq, that they're doing this also to Iraqi police, not just to civilians as well.
Right. It was just last week, I think, they found out that they were actually going to be serving a year tour of duty there, so they gotta
yes.
be.
And now they're going to find out that their hazard pay is being cut off as well.
Right,
because the Pentagon says they don't have enough money to pay U.S. troops for hazard pay.
That extra
in Iraq.
$75 a month they would be getting for that. So,
mm-hmm.
All right, we're just about out of time. A couple events coming up that we should tell people about.
Yeah, this coming Wednesday, August 20th at Meany Hall, there's going to be a benefit for Real Change. It's the Malian guitarist Jelamadi Tunkara, who is, I understand, extremely good, and I'd urge people to go see that. That's at Meany Hall at 7:30 this coming Wednesday. It's a benefit for Real Change newspaper. And then next weekend, we have a couple of events.
Well, we have something on Thursday, too.
We do.
William Rivers Pitt will be speaking at Town Hall. The lower section, we played an interview with him this morning, and that's Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at Seattle Town Hall. Friday,
on the 22nd at Bellevue, there's going to be a protest for George Bush's visit to the area. He's supposed to be over there in Bellevue on Friday and over here somewhere in Seattle on Saturday. In Bellevue from 11 to 2 p.m. on Friday at Bellevue Way and Northeast 8th, there will be a demonstration. There will also be one here in Seattle for folks who can't bus it over there from 12:30 to 3 p.m. at Victor Steinbrook on Friday. And then on Saturday, the 23rd, at noon at Myrtle Edwards Park, there's going to be some tables and some speakers and then a march to protest George Bush's visit to Seattle.
I guess that'll be waving goodbye to him as he's...
as he's leaving.
leaving.
A send-off.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking this week with Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, don't take a sip of that tea yet. You need to tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, restaurants, and other places where you find free publications. We can also be found online at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to help us out, you want to write for us, you want to rant and rave about something you heard on this show, you can call our voicemail line at 206-903-9461.